Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Flashback Doping Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a recast about Olympic drug use, the Lance Armstrong blood doping scandal,
and some wet wisdom about WADA and the Russian dopers.
Let's begin episode 347.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and, of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week we open the vaults and start off with a discussion about the use of performance-enhancing drugs at the Olympics. This is from 2012 in the lead-up to the London Games. Let's listen in. But things that I do understand is the Olympics.
Do you really?
Well, I kind of do. There's some things that do confuse me, and we're going to talk about some of that because, you know, with the Olympics around the corner, I thought it'd be a good time for us to go into some of the, you know, Olympic-themed type topics. Many may remember the glory and the shame of Ben Johnson, who set a world sprint record only to have it stripped away 2 days later in the 1988 Olympics, I believe it was.
Possibly, yes.
That time period. Because he tested positive for steroids. As it actually turned out, five of the runners in that race eventually were found to be taking some form of banned substance. So it was quite a big thing. But more importantly for us, it's kind of when the whole idea of Olympic doping came into the common Canadian psyche. Now, of course, you know, drug doping is sort of what we non-technical types would refer to as performance-enhancing drugs. But, of course, in one sense, I have to say, sort of, what is the fuss? On the one level, it seems somehow wrong that, you know, a person should be able to gain an unfair advantage by taking one drug or the other. But why is it wrong or not when one person has, you know, better equipment, better training facilities, more economic support, and all the drugs are sort of equally unfair? So, you know, some things are considered to be, well, that's okay, even though it's not equal, but drugs, oh, they're all bad. So I thought first, let's go into sort of the, like, what we're going to talk about with regards to some of the drugs here. And granted, a lot of what I'm going to say, or we're going to discuss here, are not sort of definitive things. They're almost like, well, these questions come up, and I'm curious to know what our listening audience has to say about this, and we appreciate feedback. We have one more show before the Olympic Games begin, and we shouldn't limit it to just Olympic pre-game shows. But what do you think about some of these topics we're going to run about? So the first sort of level of drugs is what I kind of refer to as the hard drugs, like anabolic steroids. These are the ones made famous by the East German women's Olympics teams because the women had bigger beards than the West German men's teams did. They work by introducing testosterone or other such sex hormones into the person's system with the belief that they will increase male traits like strength, endurance, and that sort of thing. Actually, ironically enough, thanks to the work that was done by the East German team, which were using anabolic steroids for a long time, we actually know that these do have an effect on the body, but then again, only to a degree. Women notice the most improvement, as well as underdeveloped men. And the women do largely because there's this like range of body possibilities, and the female range is smaller than the male range, and if you push the women into sort of the male domain, they at least get to the top end of the female range, and they begin to seep over into the middle area of the male range, so you do get a lot of dramatic increases in strength and that sort of thing. However, there's less evidence for that there's any kind of real improvement for peak athletes. And they also kind of come with a lot of severe side effects, so they've largely pretty much disappeared from the scene. The next group are what I would actually classify as soft drugs, and this is not so much moral, but this is sort of the effects that they may have on you. And this is like human growth hormone. This is sort of currently the big thing. Now, in theory, these are supposed to be as effective as steroids, but without the side effects. However, from what I've been reading and hearing, the scientific evidence for their efficacy is pretty limited.
If I can interrupt there, one of the things with human growth hormones is that there seems to be a lot of disagreement even within the sporting fields of what exactly they do. Because one of the reasons why this particular drug is popular is because a lot of the so-called baseball superstars have all been testifying that they've been taking this sort of thing, Barry Bonds and, you know, these other fellows. And it's not really clear what exactly these things are supposed to do, because they seem to be using them for radically different purposes.
Well, actually, and that's one of the things that comes into this. I mean, from what I've been hearing, the big thing that they do is they actually increase water retention. So you kind of get bigger muscles, but it's not actually bigger muscle mass. It's bigger muscle aqueous, right? Now, actually, and both of these drugs, they do actually can have a noticeable effect on non-professionals. And I might say that, you know, the Barry Bonds of the world may actually fall into this sort of range. So let's say, you know, if you or I were to take some of these drugs, well, there would likely be a marked change. However, Olympic-level athletes are sort of already at the peak of their physical capacity. So really, the effect seems to be of these drugs is more as a placebo effect. And apparently, they can have a huge placebo effect on people.
So are you suggesting that baseball players are not in peak physical shape?
Yes, I am. Although, to be fair, compared to bowlers, they maybe seem to be slightly more in shape than that.
Mm-hmm.
But the point being, I mean, to be fair, one of the things that Barry Bonds and them were noted for is, you know, they seem to bulk out, right?
Yeah.
Well, baseball players are not known as weightlifters. I mean, that's not sort of their area of expertise. So if they were taking these and they were amplifying their weightlifting ability, they had room to grow, so to speak. But someone like Ben Johnson, we mentioned at the beginning, he probably already had gotten the maximum amount of muscle mass he could under normal circumstances. And there's also the type of thing that you can get where you get sort of the deleterious effects, which obviously sports players don't want to have. If you take note that things like chicken gets pumped up with some growth hormones to increase their size, and literally they can break their bones and that sort of thing because they have too much muscle for their body to withstand.
Right.
And it is, to be fair, hard to tell some of the effects of these soft drugs or the hard drugs, because it's hard to literally do the test. I mean, you know, athletes don't want to be guinea pigs, because the minute they take them, they're disqualified from competition. And a lot of them, Lance Armstrong, and there was another bicyclist out there, are taking sort of a plethora of drugs, right? So they're taking 5 or 6 different ones. And even if you kind of know what 1 or 2 of them might do, you have no idea what the general effect will be by taking them all.
Yeah, and one of the other things with side effects, too, is that it's so poorly understood what drugs are being taken that people will attribute side effects that aren't possible with certain not all steroids, but certain performance-enhancing drugs. So the classic example is roid rage, where, you know, steroids are supposed to make you, like, crazy. And there's been reports, you know, like, particularly, like, wrestlers in the news where they kind of lose it and, like, murder their families. And everybody says, oh, it's roid rage. But a lot of times the drugs that they're taking are not the kind that would cause that reaction. They're something totally different, which means they're just crazy for a different reason. But a lot of the times we hear about side effects like, oh, don't be like Barry Bonds because you're going to get roid rage. Well, Barry Bonds didn't take steroids. I mean, as far as we know, he took other performing enhancing drugs.
Well, and that also falls into sort of the classic stereotypes, like testosterone is supposed to make you more aggressive because it's the man drug.
Mm-hmm.
But that ignores the fact that everyone has a certain level of testosterone, and even people who have high testosterone naturally don't necessarily have any sort of super maleness effects on them.
Yeah, they don't hulk out the way that roid rage sort of implies.
And that just, it leads to the fact that humans are very complex entities, and we don't have a large understanding of how our growth really takes place in the massive complexity that it comes in real life. Another level of drugs that are sort of big in the news at the moment are those that sort of change the body's ability to, the ones we've been looking at change the body's ability to improve itself. So it's building muscle, it's making more of this, making more of that. The next level of group sort of improves the ability for the body to supply things. So the big one is blood doping. And this is the one that Lance Armstrong has been accused of. Blood doping can be anything, is anything that really increases the amount of blood in your body system. Early attempts to do this involved actually blood transfusions, to literally put more blood in there. Currently, there are drugs out there that actually increases the body's ability to produce red blood cells. And the idea is that the more oxygen you have in your system, the more endurance you have, the longer you can last before you collapse.
This is the one that a lot of hockey players are accused of using. And there's been much ado about nothing, but we're not quite sure, about how much this would actually help, or how this would help an athlete compared to, say, standard steroids that we're more familiar with. Because this one, especially for a sport like hockey that's a lot of cardio, this one could be really beneficial if you can last longer, so to speak, than your opponent could, regardless of having muscles. This is your ability, your endurance, really.
Well, that actually, see, that brings up another interesting, and as you mentioned, there's sort of a lot of complex and contradictions here, because in hockey in particular, the amount of time that any particular player stays on the ice in a modern game is, I think, a few minutes. Relatively short period of time. If you go back to like the 60s or the 70s, players would be out for 15, 30 minutes at a time, right? And I mean, so, you know, do you really want them out there longer when it seems to be the trend is to have them sort of quick flash back, you know, this sort of that sort of train. Another example, and this may actually give the Olympics the nickname of the Purple Pea Games. That's because recent research has shown that an increased intake of nitrates found in veggies like beets, ergo purple pea, increases nitrous oxide in the blood. Nitrous oxide has been shown to improve long-distance performance and stamina. And they're not quite sure how it does it, but it certainly seems to have some minor effect. So they're expecting that all the urine samples to be handed in are going to be a slightly different color than your standard yellow. Currently, beets are not banned, but you may be surprised to know that capsaicin, yes, that's, you know, chili peppers, actually are banned, at least for horses, because apparently they're supposed to have a numbing effect on horses' things. But again, this is sort of, now we've expanded what we classify as a drug to be a much larger sort of iffier band. The last group are what I would call sort of catalysts. And these are ones that usually are seen to be pretty much unfair to have to some degree or not, but they're like pep pills. They allow the body to do whatever it normally does, but to do it faster and longer. Think of like amphetamines or caffeine, you know, PCB, that sort of thing. Although actually caffeine itself disqualified an athlete in 1972 games, it is now, of course, quite legal, although amphetamines are still banned, and I guess that's actually a good thing. There are generally believed to be sort of three rules that the Olympic Committee considers when it's going to ban a drug or not. One, is it harmful to the athlete? And again, that seems to be kind of a no-brainer on one level. Does it provide an advantage? So do I take this, and does it actually improve my performance? And is it sort of unsportsmanlike? Sort of like, does it break the sort of spirit of the games? And this is one of the ones that can be very, very iffy, because there's no real definition as to what is unsportsmanlike or what is sort of in keeping with the spirit of the games. And that's why a lot of times there's controversies arise, like caffeine. Why is caffeine wrong, but some amphetamines bad, right? Mm-hmm. So why is one good, one not the other? And apparently the idea is if you break any two of these, it's considered to be a banned substance. One point is often raised is that we need to protect athletes from the harms of drugs like steroids, amphetamines, that sort of thing. It's funny, though, because on the one level, you know, it seems wrong. But then again, we're quite willing to sit back and let an athlete abuse their body physically, but not chemically. I mean, if you think of the deleterious effects of hard training, you know, you get pulled muscle, torn ligaments, broken bones, the long-term wear and tear on their skeletal system and that sort of thing, that's okay. We don't care if you kill yourself by working your body to death, but don't you dare take that capsaicin pill or what have you. That said, I mean, I don't want athletes to sort of go down the path where they're always, you know, increasingly taking more and more different kinds of drugs, because, I mean, it's not an all or nothing sort of thing. But at the same time, it seems weird that we have this sort of weird ethos around drugs itself, and all this for the sake of Olympic spectacle. Now, the controversy arises sort of in three ways, and I've kind of gone over a bit of this before, so I'm not going to reiterate it too much. But the whole idea is, you know, drugs seem to be bad. But when it comes to other things, like there was a famous controversy a couple of years back, I think 2008 Beijing Games, where the American Olympic sports team came out in these sort of shark-finned swimsuits. And that was seen as like, oh, that's okay, sort of, but it's really sort of unfair. I mean, as it turns out, I don't think they're legal now. But it shows that, you know, why are we treating drugs so differently from the other disadvantages? I mean, shouldn't we allow athletes to become all that they can be, no matter sort of what they have? In fact, one of the weirdest things that I heard about this, and this will be my last comment on this, is apparently the London Games are pushing this sort of drug mentality to sort of a new limit, where they're going to be holding the samples for up to 8 years. So that if a new test comes up or if there's a new substance that's found to be an unfair advantage, the athletes can then be retested and they can actually have their medals taken away long after the games are over. So really, in a weird sort of way, the London Olympics are not going to really 2012 Olympics, but the 2020 Olympics. So I've run out of steam on that one, Ethan. Any comments?
Well, I mean, I think we sort of hit the main points on that one. I am curious to see what other people will think about this. So, you know, we do encourage our listeners to write in and tell us how we're wrong. info@radiofreethinker.com is that email address. We should go to a commercial break here on CITR 101.9 FM. And stay tuned. We have more after this.
Looking for something to do this summer? Come out to DanceSport BC's Summer Dance Series. Starting June 24th to September 2nd, there will be free lessons, shows, and social dancing from 7:30 to 11:30 p.m. every Friday under the domes at Robson Square. Everyone is welcome. No partner experience is required. There will be lessons for beginners and shows put on by dance professionals and local dance schools. For more information, visit their website at dancesportbc.com.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Electronics Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org.
And we're back. Okay, this clip is kind of a part two to the first one. We recorded this in the wake of the Lance Armstrong scandal. For those who don't remember, Lance Armstrong was a world-famous bicyclist. He was sort of the Usain Bolt of his day. When proof came out that he was blood doping, well, the sports world went kaboom. This issue is again front and center with the Russian doping scandal. More on that next week. But this is our take on performance-enhancing drugs from 2013.
So, Don, you may have heard of this fellow named Lance Armstrong.
Did he go on the moon?
No, but, you see, Lance Armstrong was a cyclist.
Oh?
And he apparently won some awards or something, I don't know. Anyway, so this guy, unfortunately, though, has just brought so much shame on his family name. His ancestors, Neil and Louis, must be just spinning in their graves.
Wait a minute. I'll stop you there, Ethan. You, nor I prior to my research, may not be aware, but Lance even faked his name, kind of. He's not actually Armstrong by birth, but by marriage. His stepfather was Armstrong. Lance's biological father was Gunderson, who was Norwegian by ancestry. So, you know, famous people like Neil Armstrong, Louis Armstrong, I think there's someone who's a baseball player named Armstrong.
Mm.
I'm sure there's lots. They needn't feel any shame about what may or may not be talked about today, because I'm pretty sure we're not talking about Lance Armstrong's ancestry, are we?
No. Well, maybe on a future show. So, basically, we're talking about Armstrong. As everyone knows, he's in the news. We're going to talk about it from a couple different angles. So, recently, after decades of denying allegations of cheating, Armstrong finally admitted to decades of cheating on a special interview with Oprah recently. So as skeptics, I think we can look at this from two perspectives. The first is sort of the rationality behind doping rules, performance-enhancing drugs, and sort of the philosophy of the concept of fair play. So, to start off with some science and some facts, there are several different kinds of, quote, performance-enhancing drugs. And we've actually discussed this before when we were talking about the London Olympics. But to quickly recap, we have things like anabolic steroids. These are the drugs that mimic the effects of testosterone in the body. They come with a whole host of side effects, including some pretty dangerous ones. They're banned by most sporting leagues in the world. There's the human growth hormones, which are supposed to grow muscle mass, although there's very limited scientific evidence they actually do anything. And there's blood doping, which is, this is the sort of main one that Lance Armstrong has been involved in. This is to boost the number of red blood cells in the body, giving the athlete more oxygen and endurance. And this can be done with either transfusions or the drug EPO. So the question is, do these substances give an unfair advantage to athletes who take them? The science seems to be unable to give us a satisfactory answer. Given that most of these are illegal, it's really hard to do any kind of long-term controlled studies to see what the effects are. It is apparent, however, from the amount of athletes who are using the drugs that many believe them to be giving them a significant advantage. That's hard to pin down as well, because, I mean, there are athletes who probably wear power balance bracelets, for goodness sakes.
Actually, and there is research done that the placebo effect is actually a major factor in a lot of professional sports.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So last time we talked about doping, we pondered over the difference between, say, taking drugs to get an advantage and having an advantage from some other source, perhaps, you know, if you have access to better trainers and equipment, that sort of thing. So I would argue that sporting leagues at some point have to draw a line between, or, well, defining what cheating is. Now, admittedly, it's going to be an arbitrary line because there's no objective form of cheating, of course. But we need to, at some point, figure out what's going to be allowed and what isn't going to be allowed. And I think that drawing that line at performance-enhancing drugs is a pretty good place to put it. Because, I mean, even if we assume, for instance, that they're not terribly effective, but I think that we know, for example, that blood doping is probably one of the more effective forms. Giving you that oxygen boost is a pretty big advantage. So I think drawing that line at drugs is a pretty good place to start for a couple of reasons. One, I think most of these drugs are already illegal in most countries. In fact, the U.S. has pretty strict rules on possession of these drugs without a prescription. So it's not really fair for U.S. athletes if, Canadians are able to take these pills that would get an American thrown in jail for 10 years or even having them on their person. Another reason would be health risks. We know that sports are dangerous activities. And in fact, we're finding out pretty recently that they could even be deadly. Head injuries in hockey and football, for instance, have really shown us that there are some pretty long-term and frightening results from repeated concussions. Nevertheless, having athletes secretly injecting drugs in locker rooms is really not any kind of better situation. The pressure for athletes to dope up to compete could lead them to take the wrong kind of performance-enhancing drug, or it could lead them to take something that's going to be really bad for them. There are a lot of health risks for many of these drugs. And because they're illegal, they're going to be less inclined to get help for it, which is something that we talked to Dr. Thomas Kerr about, that if it's illegal, you're less likely to seek out medical attention. Now, another reason, and this goes to sort of creating that, quote, level playing field. Most sports leagues have kind of equal footing when it comes to training. So, for example, the Vancouver Canucks don't really have an advantage over, say, the Detroit Red Wings when it comes to trainers or equipment. I mean, both teams are going to have very large budgets for that kind of thing. Their athletes are going to be able to get training year-round in the summer during the league. They're going to have access to some really good doctors, that kind of thing. And in some cases, very proactive doctors, as we learned about the Calgary Flames. Now, this is the exception to this, of course, is the Olympics, because athletes are supposed to be amateurs in the Olympics. Well, supposed to be. They're not really anymore. And they don't really have access to these resources. And I think one of the most stark examples was in the London Games. I think the gold medal, the women's gold medal weightlifter was living like below the poverty line or something in America. So some countries throw significant resources at training Olympic athletes. Some countries don't. So that creates a really uneven playing field. So athletes feel inclined to take performance-enhancing drugs. And also, which was pointed out to me earlier, that wealth disadvantage also works for performance-enhancing drugs, because you have wealthier athletes that can afford performance-enhancing drugs versus athletes who can't. So that's why I think that drawing that line in the sand, saying, okay, listen, we're gonna let you throw as much money as you want training yourself, but as soon as you start crossing over that line into illegal substances, we're going to kick you out.
So, Ethan,
yeah.
And our audience members, you like a little fire, so I'm going to throw in a little fire here. You hypocrite, you. No. So there are some things in here that I think I would take, I don't know if exception with, but so first of all, the fact that some of these drugs are illegal are not necessarily illegal for any necessary health reasons, right? They're illegal because, as you say, they are deemed to be unfair. So that's kind of a circular logic there, that a number of these drugs, if we said it was okay to dope in sports, would not be illegal in themselves.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. I mean, the reason that things like steroids are illegal has a lot to do with sort of the social taboo of using them. But, I mean, they can also be dangerous on their own.
Which leads into the second part where you talked about when Dr. Carr was in here, that one of the things that makes drug use in the sense of heroin and all that dangerous is the fact that, A, it's illegal, and, B, these people are sort of self-medicating. They don't have health professionals to help you. Whereas if we took drug doping out of the closet, out from the shadows, that where, you know, you didn't have to do it in secret in your locker room, but you actually had a trained physician and you were doing it with the trained physician to make sure that you not only got a benefit from it, but you didn't sacrifice your health at the same time, I think that would alleviate your number two criticism with regards to that.
Well, what I would say to that, I agree. Like, if you had someone there who could advise the athletes, I think the best way out of that would be basically to have a policy in sporting leagues is that if you do take performance-enhancing drugs that are against the rules, and you go to your team doctor or whoever and say, listen, I've been taking these drugs, have a blanket policy of saying, okay, well, everybody makes mistakes, so we're not going to punish you, we're not even going to publicize it, the league will know, but no one else will, and we're going to, you know, show you how to not take them, and et cetera, and how to do it safely. So basically, and this is something that I've actually heard a couple times before, Michael Shermer, who is an avid cyclist, has talked about how to get rid of doping is to basically say, okay, everyone who's done it now, we're not going to punish you. It's the only way to sort of bring it out of the woodwork, so to speak, to get people to talk about it. So I think you can have an open policy on it without making it not against the rules.
So, but again, it still seems, as you point out, arbitrary, but I think unnecessarily arbitrary to have banned them. And this goes into your third part. And on this, I think I'm going to say yes and no is one of my favorite lines to say.
Mm-hmm.
So with regards to the Olympic athletes or that sort of thing, I think it's much easier to make this arbitrary line in the sand that we need to have something fair and balanced. Although that being said, as you just said, that's actually an impossibility, because not only do you have the idea of drug enhancements, you have training enhancements, lifestyle enhancements, those sort of things. And oddly enough, I think if the Olympics wanted to do that, they would sort of supply all of the where for all, and then athletes would sort of apply to use this facilities, and then you'd actually have sort of your level playing field. But the other part of it is, in your example, you use the Canucks. And we were talking a little before the show that things like professional sports is actually entertainment. It's not really sports. Sports is the excuse. But it's really entertainment. At which point, the more entertainment, the more better, if you know what I mean. I mean, as long as, again, there has to be factors about health and that idea. So I'm not saying, you know, we should allow athletes to shoot up with PCB before a game because that'll make for a more exciting game. That's taking it. So we're assuming that these are performance-enhancing drugs that under medical conditions seem to be safe, and that this is a sporting entertainment sort of event. And as you point out, they'd all more or less be able to apply equally because they're all rich people or have access to the same sort of facilities. I don't see why that would be an unlevel playing field.
Well, I'm actually going to get to that point in our next section. So now we're going to get a bit philosophical here, discussing Armstrong. So he cheated. What does that mean for our perception of fair play and honesty? Well, let's look at some of the context here, because this is obviously a special case. Not only was Armstrong put on a pedestal for his achievements of being a top athlete and after a battle with cancer, he was sort of the poster boy for hard work paying off, et cetera, et cetera.
Thanks, Nike.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the course of his career, Armstrong was actually, in reality, kind of a jerk. He took millions in endorsements and charity. He would sue newspapers and journalists that accused him of doping, which we know he was lying about. And he would also bully his teammates into doping, or he would have them thrown off the team.
And it's important to note, especially with the suing journalists and all that, he just didn't sue them. I mean, he went after them like a pit bull to a raw steak. I mean, he was vicious and violent, and I mean, it was. This is where he's more than just a bad person.
He's gonna get it because I mean, I was just reading an article. I think the Daily Mail in the UK. He sued them for about £1 million. Now they're coming back at him, and they want all of it back plus £100,000 in interest. I mean, and the thing is, too, like, the sad aspect of this is that he would donate a lot of this money to his charity. So now you're in the position of revoking money from a cancer charity, which I think, I mean, it's just kind of a terrible situation. And it's, you know, really stupid that he did this. So anyway, we can say his actions are quite despicable. And this leads to the question of why do we feel this way? You know, we don't seem to like cheaters is the easy answer. You know, if you're playing a board game with somebody and you found out someone was cheating, you're likely going to be annoyed and you don't want to play with them. This concept of competition is that it's a structure with a set of guidelines that everyone adheres to, and that breaking these guidelines spoils the competition. And you can even apply this to things like academics. If you look at a course as a competition, the final exam is, you know, your guidelines. You have, you know, no phones, no leaving the room, no books and such. And if you're doing your final exam and you look over and you see someone with an iPad and a list of books and sources and stuff like that, and they get an A+ and you get a C, you're going to be rather annoyed by this.
But, well, what if you got an A+? What if they got an A+ and you got an A? Would that, I mean, so that okay, we'll skip that part. There is an interesting evolutionary psychological reason that we don't like the idea of cheating, is that if you're in a social community group, and everyone is expected to carry their weight to do some task for the group. Let's say fight a battle to defend yourself against the bad guys over the hill. And I'm fighting, risking my life, and I find out Ethan here is hiding behind a rock. He's sort of cheating. Well, that kind of makes him a detriment to our community, and there's a very strong social pressure to make sure that everyone follows the same rules. Ironically enough, of course, we have the same evolutionary pressure pushing against that because Ethan, I shouldn't make you sound like a coward, but you're actually a genius. Because by hiding behind the rock, you're less likely to die, which means your genes are much more likely to continue. So we have this bi-directional sort of push where, as a society, we want everyone to be on the same playing field, but as an individual, we all sort of have this urge to cheat because that is to our own personal advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the context of gaming, though, and again, like I say, there's sort of the two levels here. If you're dealing with the Olympics, I think there's a much more stronger sense that that you want to have this sense of fair play, even though, again, I think it's an impossibility to achieve, but we'll go with the illusion. But when you go with sportutainment, I don't quite see why it needs to seem to be as fair as you necessarily mean, as long as it's entertaining. I mean, everyone goes into it, they know what's going on, and they still enjoy it. I mean, you watch a movie about where, you know, the bad guy gets killed in the end, you're not annoyed that the whole movie was against the bad guy. You're like, well, this was a fun movie, I'm glad I watched it. And even with the sports teams, if they're all doping, it's still a level, it's a raised level playing field, or lowered, I guess, depending on your ethical stance, but it still has that, they're not cheating. Right?
Because
if everyone's following the same rules, and if part of that rule is you're allowed to take performance-enhancing drugs, then I don't see where it is an unfair playing field. Again, I think the Olympics is a different kind of case, but for professional sports, if all the teams and all the players are allowed to take performance-enhancing drugs, that strikes me as still a level playing field.
Well, assuming, though, that they are legal and that people want to use them. See, the thing is, there is this idea that, you know, if someone is going to be doing sports, whether it's baseball or hockey or something like that, we expect to see extraordinary levels of athleticism. So, you know, it's not good enough to see a Wayne Gretzky or someone score 500 goals. We want to see 1,000 goals. And, you know, it's not good enough to have someone win the home run derby. We want to see them smash the records every time. So I think the flaw behind this thinking is that it's not in an isolated vacuum. Because if you look at the NHL, for example, it's not just the NHL. It's also the AHL, which is the farm league. And then you have the junior hockey league under that. And then you have, you know, kids playing hockey under that. And then you also, of course, have international competition. So if the NHL allows doping and the European Hockey League doesn't, basically it's wiped out international play, because you can't have the two leagues work this out. If you want to have a uniform, that's why I say it has to be a uniform arbitrary system in place so that every league follows the same set of rules.
Yeah, but again, I'm going to go back to the Olympics, and you're more a sports person than me, so maybe I'm wrong in this idea. But one of the recent, quote, innovations of the Olympics was to allow professional players to play on Olympic teams. So when you have the Canadian Olympic hockey team, they're NHL players on that hockey team, which really seems to be unfair for the Kenyan hockey team, who obviously probably doesn't have as many NHL players on it.
Not as many, no.
Right. So, but at the same time, though, I mean, this is still seemed to be a level playing field in the context that it's allowed.
Well, I don't think it's quite the same. I mean, like, it's sort of, you know, you could look at Usain Bolt, the fastest guy in the world type thing. Can anyone name any of the other like six guys who were in that race? It's like you only remember the guy who won. And likewise, I think that sort of factors in. It's not a question with the Olympics of, you know, universal fair play. Everyone knew going into that race that Usain Bolt was going to win. It wasn't like, you know, the guy from France was going to beat him.
No, but just to make sure, there are differences amongst, I mean, you use your European, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, the American Hockey League, or the hockey rinks that we use here, are different dimensions than what they use in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's an unfair advantage, however, whichever way you want to play that. I mean, if we're in Europe, I guess the Europeans have the advantage, because I think it's a bigger rink.
It's a bigger rink in Europe, and it's a smaller rink in North America, yeah.
So again, I think you have a stronger argument with the idea that, you know, do we want to have a society that is medicating children into this sort of sports line. But then I would go back, and I mean, I think one of the things I remember, the American Olympics they had in, the big one in the 80s, 84 Olympics, which was in someplace. Anyhow, one of the people there had won the ice rink or whatever, and they had this big thing about how, you know, since she was like 6 years old, 6 a.m. in the morning, 5 a.m., dad would get up and they'd drive her to the rink and she'd skate. Well, that strikes me as a horrible thing to do to a child. I mean,
well, unless they enjoy it.
Well, but do they? I mean, does a six-year-old child naturally have the urge to skate 3 hours every morning, every day?
Well,
or is there like, well, you know, you like skating. Do you want to be good? Well, let's go get you onto this program.
Well, I mean, there's a certain extent of that. I mean, like, you can look at someone like Wayne Gretzky, who was practically born on the ice. I mean, a lot of people who play, a lot of the kids who play professional sports usually do so because they like it and they don't want to stop. I mean, that was my experience with it, at least. The kids who don't enjoy it usually, you know, don't play very well and they don't stick with it.
Well,
so
you get the example, and again, I hate to fall into stereotypes here, the Chinese gymnastic team or whatever, I mean, if I remember correctly, the last Olympics, there was lots of sort of stories going around that these were not kids who really wanted to do this, mm-hmm. but they were picked up and then they were put into this stream. And even if they kind of wanted to do with it, there's a lot of brainwashing going on that this is what you want to do. So my point is that, I mean, the fact that we push a lot of this stuff on children at a very young age, that in itself can be seen as a negative. And I agree, I don't think we should be doping up kids when they're like 10 years old, but I don't think we should be making them run 5 hours every morning because of the same ideal that you're going for.
Well, I think that's a separate argument, though. Like, I don't think we can excuse one type of bad behavior with another. I think that we have to figure out what is the best course of action for the whole system. And I think that taking a sort of prohibitionist stance with doping is probably one of the better options for the whole
thing. And I will not disagree with you on that. But, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, fighting in junior leagues is banned, right? I mean, you're not...
Most of them,
when
yeah.
You're in the, when you're in the
junior leagues. Well, you're a little kid, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's... And it, even if in the like, not... like, if you're 15 years old or whatever, even
I think
there,
it comes in, like, around 18 or something.
Right. So, but I mean, fighting in professional hockey happens all the time, and it's considered to be part of the strategy of hockey. I mean,
well,
at least it was in my day.
It was, yeah.
Right?
It's banned in pretty much every other league, too.
Okay, but the idea is, though, is that you have the professionals doing one thing, but the amateurs aren't allowed. So the professionals couldn't be taking drugs because they made it to that level.
Well, that actually goes into sort of what we were talking about. We're almost out of time, but quickly, about sports injuries. The way that we're changing our perception about, like, concussions. And you look at how, you know, it wasn't that long ago that hockey players didn't wear helmets. You know, you would see Bobby Orr or somebody without a helmet on. You think nowadays that's crazy, but that was one of the things. And you look at how we've changed our perception of young people playing sports. And ironically, one of the more interesting things I've heard about this was, I think on an episode of Penn and Teller, they were talking about injuries in football, comparing it to, like, I don't know, other injuries. And it is quite brutal. And I think that we're changing our perception of what we're willing to tolerate for kids and what we're willing to tolerate for, you know, grown adults. And it is a pretty interesting argument about, you know, the new regulations that we're seeing happening at the grassroots level for kids and how it's working its way up the ladder. I mean, you're getting this kind of the old guard in the NHL who don't want to wear visors and they don't want to wear neck guards. And you have a generation of kids who have been said, no, you're wearing visors and you're wearing neck guards, whether you want to or not. And as they come into the league, it's changing the perception of you know, sort of tough guy machoism into more sort of like, no, I kind of want to use my eyes when I'm, like, you know, 45 years old.
You're not saying ethics are evolving.
They might be.
So, Ethan, I have a confession.
Yeah?
Before the show, I took a performance-enhancing drug. I took caffeine, which stimulates the brain. So I don't think we've had a fair playing field on the show.
That's... Well, next time you can take some more caffeine and we'll level things out a bit.
And as we race to the finish, let's do some break doping. We'll be right back.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources. Know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, your performance-enhancing skeptical radio broadcast. And we're back. This last clip is from This Week Tonight on the Russian doping scandal and its implications for sports in general. Let's listen and laugh.
But while the Olympics feature thrilling displays of athletic prowess, they can also take place beneath the dark shadow cast by doping scandals. And this Olympics is no exception.
According to a report that reads like a Cold War spy thriller, Russian secret agents and a mysterious Moscow laboratory were used for state-sanctioned doping. A Russian athlete and trainer secretly filmed drugs being handed out like candy.
Russia accused, staggeringly, of using its security services, its new KGB, to tamper with supposedly tamper-proof bottles, allegedly using this hole in the laboratory wall to switch samples.
It's true. A Russian lab used a secret hole in the wall in an attempt to win Olympic medals, making this the first known example of a literal glory hole. And just listen to how the athletes ingested some of the drugs in the first place.
Ronchenkov's cocktails of three different performance-enhancing drugs were, on his instructions, washed down by athletes with alcohol to shorten the detection period. Chivas for male athletes, vermouth for the ladies.
Wait. Vermouth for the ladies? Look, I get doping is still going on, but I'd hoped that unnecessarily gendered illegal products died out with the Virginia Slims crack pipe. Hashtag feminism, hashtag crack pipes. Now, Russia's track and field team is currently banned from competing at the upcoming Olympics, but there's nothing new about this story. For as long as there's been science, people have used it to juice the human body. In the 1920s, a Russian-born French surgeon grafted thin slices of chimp testicles into people's scrotums, which was obviously ridiculous. These days we know you need a thick slice of chimp testicles. That's when it starts to work. And there's a long history of athletes circumventing the rules. In the 1904 Olympics, one of the marathon runners rode 11 miles in a car. A move that takes balls so big, they must have included a massive slice of chimp nuts. Now, as for the modern era, while no one knows exactly how many athletes dope, there are some shocking hints. One leaked survey found that an estimated 29% of track and field athletes at the 2011 World Championships said that they had doped in the past year. And presumably, that doesn't even include roided-out athletes who responded by yelling, "Survey, make me angry," crumpling it up and throwing it to the moon. But the prevalence of doping is a little surprising when you consider how rigorous the testing regimes in top sport can be. Watch what happens to one runner just seconds after she crosses the finish line.
From now until she's able to provide a sample, two things will be constant: water and Flanagan's anti-doping chaperone. The chaperone makes sure the athlete doesn't try to cheat her drug test.
It's a big-time buzzkill, because you're really excited and you want to enjoy the moment, but then at the same time, you got to get focused and get ready to pee.
Now, that's got to be tough, because you're probably not ready to pee on command just after finishing a race. That's not what your body is prepared to do at that moment. It's like asking someone to have an orgasm in the middle of test driving a Nissan Cube. It's not going to be easy. That could take a while. But despite rigorous testing, athletes are clearly slipping through the cracks for a number of reasons. For a start, there are multiple tests, and none of them can detect the full range of drugs an athlete might be on, from anabolic steroids, to EPO, to human growth hormone, to the most powerful drug of all, love. And testing itself, it's much less black and white than you might assume. There are wide variations in human biochemistry, so to avoid false positives, testing thresholds are often deliberately high, and athletes can dope and still come below those thresholds by doing things like microdosing or using masking agents to hide banned substances. And those are just some ways that it's possible for top athletes to cheat while still being able to say things like this.
People are smart. Do they say, "Has Lance Armstrong ever tested positive?" No. Has Lance Armstrong been tested? A lot.
Wow. That is some confident lying. Which isn't really surprising. Remember, this is a man who looked America dead in the eyes and said, "Bicycling is a very cool sport," and we f***ing believed him. And the techniques some athletes have used to beat the system have been amazingly imaginative. Take, for instance, the European cyclists who would insert condoms of clean urine into their anus
and then, in order to conceal everything, would cover it with fake hair blending into the real hair of the nether regions. And you have to imagine that to convince a cyclist to do that, a coach would need to deliver the most inspirational speech in the history of sports. And when they have tested positive, the excuses have been even more imaginative. Former sprinter Dennis Mitchell insisted his positive test for testosterone was the result of having sex at least four times the night before and drinking five bottles of beer. And if that is what your life is like, you don't really need the Olympics. Now, other athletes have blamed positive tests on eating a pie made from doped-up racing pigeons or eating a stew of meat and organs from uncastrated boars. And I'll say this, if Wheaties is really the breakfast of champions, their ingredient list will now include pigeon meat and pig jizz, or it's over. But none of that beats my favourite excuse of all time.
Cyclist Tyler Hamilton had to explain why somebody else's blood was in his veins. He claimed a vanished twin absorbed by his body in the womb. The court didn't buy it.
And in a way, you can see why athletes might want to dope. A split-second advantage can make the difference between winning and losing, and there's a lot of money on the line for everyone. There is a massive financial ecosystem dependent on spectacular athletic achievement in scandal-free games, and that includes the networks, who reap over $1 billion in ad sales, the IOC, which reaps billions in broadcast rights, and then there's the sponsors, who love using Olympic athletes for ads. The point is, when you combine all the money incentivizing athletes to get an edge with all the imperfections of tests, you would hope there'd be a robust, independent monitoring system in place. Unfortunately, some countries lack the resources for strong testing, while others seem to lack the desire. And to get a sense of just how compromised the system can become, let's go back to what happened in Russia, because here's how things worked. This is a Russian track and field athlete. He would compete for his national sports federation, in this case, ARAF. That federation would be under both the international body governing track and field, the IAAF, and the Russian Ministry of Sport, which is, of course, part of the Russian government. Now, separately, he would be tested by his country's anti-doping agency, in this case, RUSADA, who would send it to a laboratory which is credited by the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, which receives funding from both the IOC and countries like Russia. And already, you can see this system looks like a sprawling mess. But I guess technically it could work if each step was genuinely committed to stamping out doping. However, you've already seen that one lab had a glory hole, and on top of that, a recent investigation found that RUSADA officers routinely accepted bribes from athletes and gave them advance notice of when they'd be tested, and it also found the former head of ARAF had worked with the director of that glory hole lab to conceal positive drug tests. And while you would hope that the IAAF would have been rooting all of this out, the head of their anti-doping department was banned for 5 years after an ethics investigation. At which point, this is all actually making FIFA look good. FIFA. F***ing FIFA. And they are basically just the mafia with slightly better branding. And finally, there is WADA. Now, they are supposed to help prevent things like this, but their investigation of the scandal got off to a rocky start because we really only have all this information thanks to a whistleblower, a former RUSADA employee named Vitaly Stepanov. He approached WADA with a great deal of information, but their response was not reassuring.
He sent 200 emails and 50 letters detailing what he had witnessed. But Vitaly says WADA told him it did not have the power to investigate inside Russia.
Now, that is true. At that point, WADA didn't have the explicit authority, but that's a bit weird in and of itself. You don't want the Global Anti-Drug Agency to basically have the authority of mall cops. Hey, thief, stop or I'll be forced to go straight to the food court and grumble about your behavior into a bag of Wetzel's pretzel Cinnabits. And while WADA now has more authority and has appointed an independent commission to investigate the evolving Russia scandal, their head, Craig Reedy, sent a weirdly cozy email to an advisor to the Russian sports minister saying, "On a personal level, I value the relationship I have with the minister, and there is no intention in WADA to do anything to affect that relationship," which is an unsettlingly chummy tone for a regulator to take. If Tom Colicchio promised to judge Top Chef fairly, but then said to one contestant, I value my relationship with you and will do nothing to affect it. The other contestants would rightly think, this is clearly pointless. Here's a hot pocket. Go f*** yourself. And at this point, I'm supposed to tell you that Russian officials and the former head of Araf have broadly denied all these accusations. And for his part, Reedy says he's done nothing to interfere with the commission's investigations and his email had been misconstrued. And, you know, sure. And while this clearly isn't the system we need, it might actually be the system we want. Just listen to former head of WADA, the phenomenally named Dick Pound, who has a depressing theory about why more dopers aren't caught.
Machinery's all there. The question is, do people really want it to work? I mean, you can do hundreds of thousands of tests and then catch nobody if you don't want to catch anybody.
Is that what you think is happening, that people don't want it to work?
People don't want it to work.
Okay, well, first, Dick Pound should really insist that everyone call him Rick or Rich if he really wants anyone to fully listen to him. But second, he actually wrote a report for WADA assessing the state of drug testing, which found among the broader sports community, there is no general appetite to undertake the effort and expense to deliver doping-free sports, which is pretty alarming. We're treating good testing like calorie counts on restaurant menus. Oh, everyone might say they want it until they find out that one blooming onion is 32 million calories, and then they are f***ing done. And you might be thinking, well, let's just give up. Why don't we just let everyone dope? But that is definitely not the answer. For a start, that could be very dangerous, with athletes tempted to take greater and greater amounts to get that split-second edge. And it could also potentially force clean athletes to dope, at which point you've pretty much destroyed the integrity of sport. Because if you want to know what it's like to compete against an artificially enhanced athlete, just listen to Alicia Montano. She lost at the 2012 Olympics to Maria Savinova, one of the Russian athletes implicated in the current doping scandal.
This was the first time Montano allowed herself to watch the race. She lost to gold medalist Maria Savinova. Montano had led the race for about 600 meters before finishing fifth.
I mean, Savinova passed you like you were, with all due respect.
Literally standing still.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you realize, at that moment, I realized I'm racing against robots.
Robots.
I'm racing against robots.
She's racing against robots. And when she competed against those same Russian athletes at the World Championships the next year, it was deja vu.
Savinova blew by her in the last 50 meters to finish second. All Montano could do was throw herself across the finish line, beaten, and for the first time, broken.
And I felt really failed and really betrayed, and I actually felt like my career was a farce, you know, that this is just, what am I doing out here? What's the point?
What am I doing here? What's the point? She's a world-class athlete, and she was left feeling like anyone who paid for a ticket to Now You See Me Too. What are we doing here? What are any of us doing here? What's the point in this? What are we doing? And look, we focused on Russia here because the details are spectacular, but they are far from the only offenders. In recent years, Kenya, Jamaica, and China have all had doping scandals, and American athletes have cheated too. Justin Gatlin and Tyson Gay have both been banned for doping in the past, yet they're still expected to compete in Rio for the US team. So think of doping like Vladimir Putin. It's far from just a Russian problem. It's something that adversely affects the entire world. So it feels like we have two choices. At this point, if we truly want to clean up sports, we should empower WADA by making it truly independent and put pressure on the broader sports system to aggressively combat doping.
And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.